Okay, guys, for this ad break, me and Adam actually want to talk to you during this ad break for once. We want to talk to you specifically about Vivid Seats, who is a great ticket company that will sell you your tickets to whatever event you're going to go to. Adam, what do you like about Vivid Seats?
Well, so you can get an offer of on $200 or more, you can save 20 bucks, get 20 bucks off on 200 or more. As we know, preseason's coming around. Opening night is what, 6 weeks away? No, 32 days away. I'm thinking September 1st or 32 days away. 31. Well, yeah, because we're recording on a Sunday. So 31 days away, you can buy tickets to that game. There's a game that weekend, I believe. There's games all season long. You can buy tickets to that. Whether you want to go to Colts games, I know we interact with that. Or you go to a concert or whatever it is. If you buy $200 worth of tickets, so you take the family out, you know, you and your wife and your kids or whatever it is, you get $20 off. It's a pretty good deal, especially if you're buying a lot of tickets. It's a great deal for that kind of thing.
Yeah, so I couldn't actually make it up, obviously, to see the Vikings, my Vikings yesterday. I was checking Vivid Seats around for figuring how it worked. It was really great. You can sort by location. You can sort by price. It's really great. It's very user-friendly. And you can get it on the App Store. You can get it on Google Play. You can get it on your Android. It's really awesome. But like Adam said, also, there's a 100% guarantee that the tickets will work. But also, like Adam said, the best part is you can receive $20 off any order of $200 or more if you use our promo code LOCKEDON, LOCKEDON, to save your money on Vivid Seats.
I think I'll probably use it to go to a Colts game maybe at some point this year. Those tickets are costly. So definitely be good to use.
But they could be less costly if you get 10% off using our code LOCKEDON.
That's code LOCKEDON.
So Vivid Seats, go check it out, guys. And back to the show.
You are Locked On Pacers, your daily Indiana Pacers podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team every day.
And joining me now on the Locked On Pacers podcast is one of my fellow writers, IndyCornrows.com, one of the best Pacer writers out there in the, the Pacers blogging world, writing, whatever you want to call it, one of the great writers, and that's Caitlin Cooper. She has a season preview, actually, the time this podcast coming out on IndyCornrows today. Caitlin, how are you doing?
Hey, I'm doing good. Busy. Preview season is a busy time.
Yeah, it is. I may or may not have taken a peek at your preview since I know I have access to the back of the site to see what you were sort of getting queued up for for Monday at least. So on today's podcast, I think we're going to do sort of a top storylines kind of thing I was thinking. So we're going to basically, Caitlin made a list of top five storylines. I made a list of top five storylines heading the season. We're going to just do reverse order and we're going to see who overlaps and whatnot. We'll just talk about them. Anything you want to preface before we get to kind of your top five storylines?
No, I think I'm ready. I'm prepared. I've thought long and hard about these rankings.
All right, so you go first. So let's do, what's your number five storyline heading into the Pacers season?
Okay, so at number five, I picked this as number five simply because I don't know how pressing it's going to be during the regular season. So without further ado, I'm looking at the wing rotation. How's that going to shake out as far as like last year in the playoffs with Bogdanovich? Like he had that great game three, but otherwise, like you could kind of tell that having to go full out and be guarding LeBron kind of impacted his shot. Outside of game three, he was 10 of 36 on threes. So, you know, they got Doug McDermott on board now, and he's going to be able to mitigate some of that fatigue. And, you know, if there's dry spells on the part of Bogdanovich for shooting, they have that. But are the two of them going to be able to tag team against some of the wings they're going to see in a playoff scenario, if that makes sense?
Yeah, that 100% makes sense. That's actually the number three thing on my list. We're going to have this entire time, just so everybody knows. We're going to have similar ideas at different rating spots. So I agree with you. And also the sense of the defense is what worries me at the wings particularly.
Exactly.
It's not the shooting. I mean, you know, Bojan was up and down throughout the season, but overall 40% from three. McDermott, I mean, his small sample size last year is at almost 50%. So they're going to be able to score or at least be kind of effective offensive players and trying to like stretch the floor. But like you said, I'm worried, especially because there are a decent amount of like pretty good forwards in the East. I mean, if you're going kind of got Kawhi, he's probably the best one. You got Hayward or Tatum, whoever's playing that spot. And then you've got Giannis, who is playing some form of forward center kind of role. So like, who guards those three guys is kind of the question. And so in the playoffs, that's right, they played Bojan on LeBron. But, like, what happens? You know, they put Thad on one of them. But, you know, if Thad declines a little bit, what happens there? It just worries me, I think, at all, is what happens with the forward spots because they're they don't really have a great defender. Bojan was sort of just like, he was better than he was in previous years, but he wasn't anything like exceptional versus like, you know, they're really good at the guard spot when they play Joseph too on defense, but the forward spot's like really bad.
Right. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily come into play because what you just said about that. I mean, we don't know how exactly he'll age. He's over 30 now. I mean, I don't expect him to have a huge drop off or something, but it comes into play with teams that are going to have those multiple wing lineups. I mean, like what Boston plans to run out there with Jaylen Brown and Tatum and Hayward. Like at that point, you're asking Thad to be plugging a lot of different spots potentially that he can only go on one person, obviously. I mean, Toronto is going to be able to trot out smaller lineups with multiple wings. That's where it becomes a problem. I don't necessarily think it's an 82 game problem because, like you said, I mean, it's not even an offensive issue. Both of them move so well without the basketball. And I mean, at the golf outing, I will have this a little bit in one of the previews that's coming out next week. McDermott did say that he was in town early this summer working on defensive mechanics. And, you know, that was something Bogdanovich did last summer. So I wouldn't even be surprised if we see improvement on behalf of either on Doug, similar to what we did with Bogdanovich. I just think it's a 16 game problem that we won't really know the answer to until next summer. So, yeah,
and I'm not sure even, I mean, so like even if they are better mechanically, I just don't know if they have the, I guess the right way is the body type or the speed to even compete with some of the best four. Like it doesn't, you know what I mean? There's only so good McDermott and Bojan can get. I mean, I thought Bojan, like if you look at the numbers, he made a huge stride defensively. I mean, it went from like, he was one of maybe like in the 300s ranked defensive player to like maybe in the, I think he was the low hundreds. It's a huge jump for a guy like that, but it's still, when you're going against like, I mean, most of the best players in this league are forwards. So, I mean, you know, you're going against like a Kawhi Leonard who, if he's healthy and was where he was, is the second or third best player in the NBA. I mean, or Giannis, who could be that. And though that's a lot harder, but you're right. It won't matter day to day. And I think it's also important to remember that not having Lance put a small forward spot should help just overall in this rotation. It should help a ton.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with that.
Yeah. All right. So I had that one number three, quote of, so we'll skip my number three when we get to it. But so my number five one, just cause this is more of like an overarching question I had is Victor Oladipo going to be the same, better, or was last season kind of a fluke? And I tend to lean it wasn't a fluke, but I'm not sure. You know, you don't know really until you actually see it. I mean, all the offseason indications are that he keep working hard and he's going to be the same player. But, you know, defense will adjust. They'll start to do things to him differently because they'll expect him to be the best player on the court. And, you know, there is sort of like levels, right? He hit sort of like the 23 point a game level, but there's got, you know, the next level is being a 27 points a game, which Paul George kind of a player never did, right? He got the 21, 22, 23 every year, but he couldn't get over that hump. He couldn't get to the 27 points a game kind of hump. And that's what I wonder is, can Oladipo do that? Or was the whole thing sort of caught everybody off guard? And does he have sort of is he more of like a 20 to 23 point a game kind of guy? And which is great still, but is that sort of what he settles into?
Right, that was actually my number four. I had will Victor take another leap, or will there be regression? I mean, I think with his shot last year, like with his pull-up three, that oscillated a little more than I think some people recognize. Like that went from 50 in November, clear down to 15 in February, back up to 58 in April, and it kind of mirrored that in the playoffs to an extent too. But I mean, with him and what you mentioned about him seeing different coverages, it's so much more of an advantage for the defense to play him tight, even if his shot isn't falling, because his turbo dribble is that explosive coming off that last year, even when people went under screens or when they did other stuff, he could still get past them to the rim. Even, you know, when bigs dropped way back into the paint, it really wasn't a deterrent to him. So if they're playing him tighter, this is kind of how I took it from an angle, is like what I'm looking for is he going to have like the next level of passes? Like in comparison between him and Tyreek, they do similar things, but they do them very differently. And part of the asset they have with Tyreek is because he kind of has in his arsenal, he can do those passes to the weak side corner. He has skip passes with better accuracy. He can throw throwback passes. And Victor doesn't have that yet. Now he might have added it over the summer. I mean, that's something we don't know yet. And then also like his free throw rate, kind of what you mentioned in comparison to some of the other better players, like not that I'm saying that these people are necessarily better than him, but like Butler, DeRozan, Wall, Westbrook, Booker all have higher free throw rates on their field goal attempts than Victor does. So like being able to draw contact at the rim with like Veer finishes, I think would take him to another level too. I mean, what specifically are you looking at for him to like take the next jump? Is it just more like consistency and better scoring, or
So actually, I have a, I'm writing something for our website, Nick Cornrows, about this right now. So I sort of like a two path. So the free throw path is in the Rosen kind of path is what you kind of hit is perfect. I mean, he only took, so I think he took 4.9 free throws per game. Guy DeRozan got to like seven, or I think 7.5 somewhere was kind of his number last year. So that's a huge thing, right? If Vic can get another two free throws a game, that's a whole extra point basically added per game, at least, because he averages, like, I think it's a 79.9% free throw shooter. So that's kind of where I see it. But I could see him kind of going two ways, right? He could become, you know, the 20 shots a game and shooting, let's say 48, 38, and 80, kind of that kind of stat line. And that gets him to 27, 26 points. Or you could do like he, like you kind of one I actually prefer is, becomes a more kind of elite passer where he is fine with the 17 shots, 18 shots because he's the closer or whatever, but he becomes more of the distributor at times, setting up guys like Turner, who I think we can both agree felt like was relegated in terms of offensive impact last year, right? They didn't let him shoot as much, and that's why his stats dropped a little bit. I mean, he shot, I think, 11, almost 11 times his second year, and last year he shot about 9.2 times per game. So that's where his points per game came down. And so, you know, you'd like to see him be kind of that player, especially because they have, when they put, you know, Bojan and Collison, and if Turner gets 3 points or stuff, they really put five or three or four solid shooters around him. He can kind of, you know, have the ability, because he's so fast, to draw defenders in and kick out to anybody if he just kind of sees it. And so that's what I like to see. Like, I like to see him have like a 25 point a game with like 8 assists and 8 rebound kind of season. Like, I know 8 assists is probably a little high, but something like that, because that sort of shows that he, because he seemed like a player who wants to be more of a leader and like sort of helping out other teammates versus like the quintessential, like, just I'm going to score at will, like a DeRozan kind of that way sometimes, or Lillard is sometimes that way. Those kind of guys are more like, I'm just going to take 20, 22 shots. I'm going to hit and try to hit them all because I'm the best player.
Right. Yeah, I also think like his lock and trail defense, like as good as he was as a defender last year, and he's so elite at roaming off, you know, whoever the least threatening wing option is, but like his lock and trail defense against like Korver in the playoffs could take another step, because sometimes, because he is so quick and he can kind of anticipate where the next person's spot's going to go, you would see him cheat under some of those pin down screens, where you'd rather see him, you know, leaning in on those off ball screens to entice that person to curl to the basket. So that's something I'd also be looking on at that end of the floor. But I mean, he was surprisingly really, really good on that end of the floor last year. So
yeah, I think once he started to realize that he could cut off passing lanes, and really, because he uses his long arms and his speed, it sort of changed him on the defensive end. I think in college he showed that, if I remember right, at IU. Like, he was always a pretty good defender in college, considered one at least, but then he never really showed in the pros. I don't know if that's because he never got in the shape he needed to get into last year or whatnot. But once he kind of, like you said, he figured out that he could like kind of cheat off guys at times and make the right kind of, and kind of get his hand in the way of blocking pass, because he had a ton of steals. You watch him, they're like, you know, he basically anticipates where the ball's going to go and takes that, cuts off the passing lane. But Joe, do we both agree that he's probably not going to take a step back? Because I think that, I mean, I know the SI's top 100 crossover kind of hinted that he could kind of be a fluke, last year's kind of a fluky year, and he might not be that kind of player. But we both agree that he's probably going to either be the same or maybe better in some aspects of his game.
Yeah, I mean, I would be surprised. I mean, like I said, with like the pull-up shooting, that's what you're looking at as far as regression. But even with that, because of what he did with his skilled agility and how the control he showed over his athleticism, I think pretty much he kind of is what he'll be what he was at a minimum. That's what I'm looking at. So, yeah, I agree.
Yeah, especially because he's only now he's 26 right now. So he's going to
26. Yeah.
Yeah. Right in the middle of his prime and all that stuff. So I have a hard time believing he's going to take a step back, just because at that age, you usually don't. It's sort of this kind of your, I would say 27 to 32 is sort of the peak year for NBA players. All right. What do you have for number four, or did I take number four? So what's number
three? Yeah, that was number four. So number three, I have, just looking at how the backcourt rotation is going to shake up with Corey Joseph, Tyreke Evans, and Collison. I wrote about this a couple weeks ago, but just, you know, that, and in addition to Oladipo, they averaged over 120 minutes with, you know, that Evans's minutes are coming from Memphis, so it's not directly comparable, but, you know, there's only 96 available. And depending upon which, now that Nate's kind of said that rebounding's the emphasis and they want to be a top 10 rebounding team, which is kind of a whole nother talking point, but unless they're going to play McDermott or Bogdanovich some at four, there's not going to be a lot of space for three guard lineups. And that's unless that's like an intentional matchup thing. So how those minutes are going to shake up. And then I'm still firmly on Team Houston style with Tyreke and Victor. And I'm wondering how long it will take to get to that, because I think that's going to be the end game in the playoffs, is playing Tyreke and Victor together from the start. So we'll see.
Yeah, I remember that rebounding quote. It was sort of I took it as more of they're going to play more Sabonis Turner lineups, I guess. They're going to kind of try to play two center type guys to rebound, I guess. Because, I mean, I'm personally a fan, and I don't know how long it'll take to change this, of like a Corey Joseph, Tyreek, and Oladipo three guard lineup. I mean, depending on the matchup, obviously, but I feel like those three are the best kind of three wing defenders they have. I think even Tyreek or Oladipo is better than Bojan or McDermott defense, and they provide enough offense where it's worth it. I think part is going to also be kind of trying to hide Oladipo on the defensive end sometimes to get him the rest so he can kind of dominate on the offensive end, because that's going to kind of be a thing that is going to matter. I mean, the Cavs did with LeBron all the time. They would hide him on kind of a team's and let him kind of roam around as a defender so he could get rest at times, so he could be such a dominant offensive player. But I mean, also, like you said, I think you're right. The end game is Tyreek plays point guard, Oladipo plays point guard, and they just roll out those two guys, and they let those two guys just kind of be the two best offensive players for the Pacers on the court at times, because that's what they could be. And if Turner is kind of that level, you've got three really good offensive players, and kind of that's the recipe to beat any of the really good NBA teams, at least in the playoffs.
Right. I mean, they're just going to be able to keep the nail defender completely off balance, especially with going back to some of that stuff with Victor in the passing. If Victor makes strides at that at all, he and Tyreek become that much more interchangeable. And, you know, they do many of the same things, but they do them differently, because Tyreek, with his pull-up threes, he's rising up above the pick, and that's just, you know, opening stuff up. But to me, I understand why Nate's saying he's going to stick with the original starters to start the season, because from a chemistry standpoint, I think, you know, Evans is going to have to – they're going to have to prove that, hey, these minutes with Oladipo and Tyreek, this is our best unit. But – so I get that you're not just going to roll that out from game one or preseason game one, but I mean, I think that gives them the best shot in the playoffs. And not only that, but if you do it the way Houston does, you know, Chris Paul runs those bench units. So you're not giving up the opportunity for Tyreek to run the bench. You're not playing them together that many minutes. It's just matching their minutes against the opposing team's top lineups with more regularity. Plus, with Tyreek having two knee surgeries, it's giving him an opportunity to play shorter bursts. Like, if you're starting him for a short burst with Victor, those are like 6-minute bursts instead of longer swaths with him playing over the bench, with the bench over from the end of the second, into the first quarter, into the start of the second. So, I mean, I just think eventually they're going to get to that, and I'm just going to monitor exactly how long it takes.
Yeah, I guess with Tyreek, I mean, it doesn't matter if he starts, right? It's really if he ends games. It's kind of how I'm going to look at it. Who cares if he's the starting point guard? I mean,
well, I actually do a little bit. Like, I know that that's kind of like the common thing is to say, like, it matters who finishes. But if that's going to be your end game in the playoffs, you're going to want to get him as much experience against the top lineups as you can. So if you're only going to say, oh, we're going to close halves with him, well, that's – are you only going to do that if it's a close game? Like, I'd rather they just do exactly what I would. Just look at the minute markers for Chris Paul and James Harden. And that's what I would do. Like, I know that Nate's not going to do that. He's going to start Darren Collison, but I just think the best preparation for what they're going to need to be in the playoffs is to eventually get to that. And like I said, then that's going to let Tyreek play shorter bursts where he can get rest, but they'll start Darren.
Yeah. I also just wonder, I mean, you mentioned his knee injury, and I wonder if they cut back on his minutes, like maybe make him more like a 25 to 28 minute player, if that helps him play like 70 games, because he really has only played it, right? He played 52 last year, 40 the year before that, 25 the year before that. So he hasn't played over 70 games in like three seasons. And I wonder if, you know, they did this kind of with Chris Paul, and they kind of went away from it in the playoffs, Houston did. And that kind of, I think, screwed them when he got hurt, because they play him too much. But if they could get Tyreek into like maybe a 28 a game number, it might prolong his season versus, you know, you play him 30 to 35, there's more chance he gets hurt. And that could, you know, right. You're not, I mean, you have to also play the long game a little bit, right? You're not looking at Tyreek to be, you don't need him to be his best player day one. You need him to be his best player by game 82. So it doesn't really matter whether, you know, and it depends, right, how many close games they play. Cause last year they played so many close games, he would get plenty of experience if you played the last 5 minutes of a game with the starters. Cause they seem like they were always playing 3 to 5 point games with 5 minutes left. So I agree. It's something definitely to monitor, because he probably is the second best guard player on the Pacers, right? He's better than Darren Collison. He's better than Corey Joseph, probably. He's definitely the second best guard behind Oladipo. It's just, when did they go to it?
Right.
All right. So did you, I just went, right? Or did you just go?
That was my number three.
Okay. All right. So I will do my number, right? I did my number four. So I'll do my number three is, at what point do the Pacers look at their team and decide to make a trade. So this is a big kind of thing with Jimmy Butler right now is I don't think they have the assets to figure out a Butler trade without, you know, then Minnesota taking kind of a discount. But at some point, the Pacers look at their team and say, well, we've got Oladipo, who's a number one player. We've got, let's say, Tyreek, who they think is could be the 2 or 2A, and we got Turner as a bonus. And then you got to do they decide they want to trade one of them to kind of improve? And is it something that they that kind of lingers over this team? You know, they have a lot of cap space next year. That's and with all the free agents, but does it sort of linger over the season of like, really, it's somebody's going to be traded because this team to be its best self has to make one more move. And I think, I don't know if that's going to be an issue or whatnot, but I kind of see that being kind of an overplaying image over the season.
No, yeah, I actually almost combined that with my number five with the wing solution because, I mean, I think long-term, like, I kind of want to know what the thinking is with the McDermott contract versus Bogdanovich being expiring. Like, are they thinking in the long-term, we still haven't found our starting small forward yet, and next year McDermott's going to be the reserve forward that, you know, maybe Bogdanovich would have settled into? Like, I'm not saying I don't have any intel on any of that, but, like, I think that ultimately the person that you want to be in between Turner and Oladipo or Oladipo and Sabonis, whichever person that ends up being, is an elite wing that can guard out on the perimeter and also give you offense. I mean, I don't know who that person's going to be. I was kind of looking through who free agents are going to be on at the small forward position, and I don't, you know, that's not a really super robust market, especially if Butler's going to be on the move to another team, and obviously he didn't have the Pacers on a list, and that fits a little bit. I don't know how sold I am actually on the fit with Butler and Oladipo, but I would have to look into it more. But yeah, I mean, how long will they look at? This is kind of why I wanted them to do a little bit more with Miles and Sabonis last year than they did, so that they would have a better sense going into this year if they ultimately did want to decide, hey, you know, we've looked at this and, you know, we don't know that this is going to be a viable strategy in the playoffs to take Victor where he needs to go. And let me qualify. I'm not saying that I definitely am saying that it's not going to be, but if it isn't going to be, then you can flip one of them. I mean, I think one or the other of them is a pretty decent trade asset. Plus you have, you know, expirings with Darren and Corey, where, you know, you could maybe package one of them with it, maybe a draft pick, and maybe you get a more long-term solution on the wing than what they have right now.
Yeah, I think the problem last year with Sabonis Turner too was a little bit is they only knew what they had as a bonus until like he basically started playing as good as he did. I mean, maybe they did somewhere, but I don't think they knew what they had. And by the time they figured out, Turner couldn't stay healthy half the time. Every 2 months he had his elbow injury and concussion. And I think there wasn't enough time to kind of do what you were saying last year, because I agree with you. It would have been nice to see him play together and really see if they worked. That's why you don't make the trade now, right? You really want to try it out. You just want to try it out. You want to give it, you know, a 40, 50 game stretch. It's like, does this actually work, or is it futile, basically? But I think in terms of kind of players they could look at, I mean, Middleton's a free agent next year too. He's kind of
right.
Tony likes him, the host of this podcast. But I guess your point about McDermott and Bowen, I kind of agree. I think I saw McDermott as kind of the insurance, or like the Bojan replacement who can sell into the bench role, like you're saying, because I think Bojan is sort of really better as like the sixth man off your bench and not necessarily your starting small forward. I think he's definitely, you know, if he keeps improving his defense, he's going to earn it eventually. You know, last year, I think he definitely took strides defensively that said, listen, I can actually be a starting small forward, even though people don't believe in me kind of thing. But I just, Bojan just seems like a better guy to play 25 minutes off your bench and just to come in and just drain some threes for you and kind of thing. And so it's kind of finding the right player then to play next to Vic. And if there even is one, right. And the problem is that all the best small forwards are probably going to be locked up because they're the best small forward for a reason. So I don't know what the move is to get somebody, but I do know ultimately it's going to be, if they do trade, it's going to be built around a Turner Sabonis package, one of the two, with probably Aaron Holiday and a pick or something like that. Or maybe Joseph, like you said, something to make the salaries match, whatever it is, but that's probably what it looks like.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we're on the same page there.
Yeah. So what we on, did I do your number three? So you do your number two now?
Yes, my number two is, because I kind of separated these out and I won't spoil what number one is, but my number two is just Miles and Sabonis and can they play together? I mean, I think I've written like four things about this now, because that was my actual like first gamer story from last year, as soon as, because Nate in the preseason hadn't really played them together, and then they played like 6 or 7 minutes in the opening game and you could kind of tell like, you know, this is going to be a thing to monitor. Like if Sabonis continues to blossom, you know, you're going to have to play them more together. And last year, even in the small minutes that they played, like even if you weren't going to expand their minutes load, I just wanted them to run specific offense for the two of them. Like I just don't get why that really wasn't a thing. Like how hard was it going to be to incorporate more specific sets just for Miles and Sabonis? Even in the back end of the season, it took quite a while just for them to start lifting Miles Turner out to the opposite slot and use Sabonis as the roller. Like a lot of times you could tell that one or the other of them was just sort of playing the Thad role and hanging out along the baseline, and then they were just getting in each other's way. Like, so I know that defense is going to be like the main thing, because you often have to overcome that both of them are kind of a step slow on defense on the perimeter. Like that may not be completely the same fact now that they've both kind of worked on their flexibility and their movement and their fluidity over the offseason. But to me, I still think the simpler fix is to come up with more dynamic sets on offense than it is to expect that one of the other of them are going to suddenly become quicker. Because I mean, let's face it, if you look at a lot of the bigs across the league, like I know these aren't completely comparable players, but I know like Nurkic in Portland last summer worked on becoming more nimble and more fluid so that they could switch last year. And even after doing that, like if they play Houston and they're playing a small lineup with PJ Tucker, you're still going to put Nurkic on the bench. Like, so with both of these playing together, like, to me, the simpler solution is just to do more offensively to make sure that they can outscore what they're going to be giving up. And I didn't see a lot of that last year.
Yeah, I would like to see them use Sabonis with Turner as sort of the – like, I feel like Sabonis would be more of the center on offense because he's more of a post player. And
exactly.
And he's a better passer. I mean, I think that was the real solution in the playoffs, to be honest, when they sort of – you know, when the Cavs adjusted to the Pacers with the double teams and they had to readjust back, the adjustment was – having Sabonis and Oladipo run the pick and roll. But I think Turner could fit in that lineup, because if Turner can kind of keep improving 3-point percentage, which he shot 35%, which is kind of an encouraging sign last year, maybe he can get to like 38 or 39 this year. He can really kind of be a roaming guy on the perimeter. I mean, if he can kind of sit in the corner, or you can kind of get him cutting time, because he does have the ability to put the ball on the floor at times. I mean,
right.
Sometimes it's shaky. He needs to get better at it, but he seems like he's working on that this offseason. I know I saw some of those highlight videos where he was going to get some scrubs, but he kind of is doing that kind of stuff. But the thing, I guess, like you said, is I actually was more optimistic on the defensive end at times, because in the playoffs, I thought Sabonis, now LeBron beat him a few times, but I thought Sabonis a couple times now, in like very small instances, actually was able to hold his own against LeBron for a little bit, like was able to, because he's such a big guy, was not to let, didn't let LeBron back him down and post him up as well. Kind of more like when David West used to guard LeBron when he played for the Heat, kind of reminded me of that. I wonder if Sabonis, because he's, you know, he's the way he runs is more though, like he's more kind of a center, like his center gravity is lower to the ground. He kind of has more of a natural, it's like run than Turner. If that sort of, he can develop becoming at least like, let's say an average in space defender, and that could be enough to let them play together.
Yeah. I mean, obviously it's going to depend on the lineup. Cause I mean, you know, if you're playing Boston, I just don't know. Cause like, I mean, you even saw how, you know, Gobert, Embiid, like a lot of these bigs were getting kind of played off the floor somewhat in the playoffs. So I don't know if you can double that when you're in a 16 game situation. I mean, I think that a lot of this is what's going to happen with the Pacers this year. I think Miles and Sabonis might work fine during the regular season, and it might even work fine during the first playoff series. And if they advance out of that, then I think, you know, if you're playing some of the lineups that can be more versatile and get smaller, at that point, you're going to be hoping that those teams don't make threes, I think, just because like the opponent team's 3-point attempt rate when they were on the floor last year was pretty obscene. Like it was like bombs away from three, the amount that they were attempting. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, what you said about Turner kind of floating around the perimeter, exactly. Like Sabonis is great at slipping into space, making reads in the short roll. I don't know why it took so long to lift Miles up above, because at that point, if you're running pick and roll with Sabonis and Miles is lifted, that's putting so much pressure on the tagger to decide, am I going to go tag Sabonis or am I going to close out to Turner? I mean, and just like a couple, I think at the beginning of August is when I wrote something about this. And like I mentioned a set like Horns Flare. Like, and this goes back to something you mentioned earlier with Miles and his field goal attempts going down. Like some of that, I know people like to point at, oh, if he gets a switch, he's not aggressive with it. Well, yeah, that's partially true. He needs to be more aggressive, sealing into the paint or being, you know, demanding the ball. But when he was out there with Sabonis, sometimes that space isn't there if Sabonis is on the opposite block. And if you're running Horns Flair off the screen for Miles, then Sabonis is there with a build in action to set another screen. If they switch that, Miles is open. Like just doing more stuff like that to ensure that he can remain involved in the offense. That's the responsibility of the Pacers as much as it's the responsibility of Miles to be aggressive with switches. Like to me, it went hand in hand why his touches went down last year. Like it wasn't just a Miles thing.
I also think Turner has the sometimes he looks kind of scared with the ball in his hands. I know it's something that really you can't. I mean, like, I just remember a couple of times in the Cavs series where he got the ball out of the double team on the big double team and he got it swiped away. Like, he doesn't always seem like he's confident where he wants to make his move. I remember the most confident I saw Turner last year was that Boston game where he got the switch, posted up, I think, one of the Morris brothers and scored. And he didn't hesitate, didn't think about it. He just knew what he wanted to do. But, like, most of the time he gets the ball, he doesn't look like he knows what his next move is. He doesn't realize, okay, I'm standing about the free throw line. I can drain this shot, or I can go to the rim, get two guys into me and draw, kick out. But like Sabonis, seems like he understands that. Sabonis gets the ball and he knows what he wants to do with it. He pump fakes, goes to the rim, floating, kicks it out to Bojan or Collison, whatever it is. He seems like he knows what he wants to do. Where Turner, it's but that's something that he's hopefully getting better at. I mean, I think he had those issues when he was a rookie too. And his first 3 years, he's really had a lot of those kind of issues sometimes.
It's definitely showed up in the playoffs too. I mean, I think you kind of nailed there. It's like a combination with him where he both needs to be more aggressive and calm down, like at the same time, if that makes sense. It's like he gets it out of, like, sometimes when they were trapping and he'd be getting it there at the free throw line as the release valve. It's like he almost needs to calm down and assess where the ball needs to go. And he would make, you know, sort of a really quick antsy type pass. But I mean, I think you nailed that one pretty good.
Yeah, so I guess another thing we should mention too is that Sabonis and Turner played a lot of lines with Lance last year, so some of the plus minus numbers look kind of bad, I think, because of that. I think it'll be interesting to see them play with some better players. And I guess the other hope too is that, you know, because Sabonis and Turner probably won't be their best lineup, so like when they have to switch in the playoffs to a more, you know, not basically a more kind of stretched out lineup, it might be okay to do that, because unlike, you know, the 76ers or even Utah, they don't run their offense or don't need their center to be their best player all the time. They've got Oladipo. They might have Evans who can kind of do that. So that will help them sometimes, because it's not like with the 76ers, if Embiid's not out there, they're screwed. If Gobert's not out there, the Jazz are kind of screwed. But if Turner or Sabonis isn't out there, one has to be out there only, they aren't as screwed, I think, just because they can run things through Oladipo and let him kind of both run the defense and the offense at times.
Yeah. And I think some of this goes back to, I'm still a little bit lost on McMillan's assertion that the East is going to trend more towards traditional power forwards this year.
Oh,
I've combed over it, and like I get his point about, you know, the East was, you know, sort of a copycat league of you have to be able to match LeBron and spread lineups. Like I'm with you that far, but with LeBron gone, there's going to be something that steps into that competitive vacuum, and you already know that. You know, no matter where the Pacers stack up against some of the other best teams, wherever that is, that the rest of the top of the East is going to be running small spread lineups. So I even combed through it and I'm like, we're basically looking at pairings of like Griffin Drummond. And then I know Nate mentioned that he thinks that Love will play more traditional power forward. I think they'll still have him shoot threes. But even if we accept that one, you're looking at like Griffin Drummond, Kevin Love, like maybe Rondae Hollis-Jefferson with Brooklyn. And then like there's Ibaka, Valanciunas, but like how much is Toronto even going to play that pairing? Like if you just look through the whole listing of fours for like every team, it's mostly either springy guys who are going to be able to finish around the basket when you, you know, have vertical gravity, or there's stretch bigs that are going to spread the floor. Like I don't know why he thinks that the East is going to trend more towards physical front courts. But I mean, to me, like, don't use that as a reason of why you're going to play Miles and Sabonis. Just say, hey, we think this is our, you know, our best, these are two of our best players, and we're going to be contrarian, and sometimes it's better to go and do the opposite of what everyone else is doing, and we're going to be really good at this. Like I don't know why it keeps like bringing up that they're going to be traditional power forwards. Like I could be wrong, but I look through like almost every team, and you know, now Markkanen's out, but it's like Aaron Gordon, Markkanen, Marvin Williams, Giannis, Kelly Olynyk. Like, these are all, to me, these aren't traditional power forwards, but, you know, whatever. Yeah.
Especially because you don't, I mean, maybe they'll feast against the bottom of the East, but they were probably going to do that anyways, and that's going to be fine. But dude, we want to get to the top of these, right? So, and I assume Toronto will ultimately go to, like, Kawhi or OG at the four, something like that.
Yeah, I don't expect that they're going to play. I mean, I'm not saying they're not going to do it at all, but I would be very surprised if Toronto is still playing a lot of minutes of Serge Valanciunas when they can run, you know, Kawhi, OG, Siakam minutes at four and really get, you know, more versatile there. But, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And Boston's going to do that. Like that 5-man switching lineup, so that's not going to do. They're not going to do that. I mean, they might play Morris occasionally, but they're going to run that thing. And then really, it's Philadelphia. They're the only team that, I mean, I think the Bucks are going to probably run more of a stretch. I don't know about the Wizards. Who the hell knows with them? Because who the hell actually knows what the Wizards are going to ever do?
Well, there was reports out of their training camp this week that Scott Brooks even said that they might play Otto Porter at five, which, you know, believe it when you see it, but they said that they might play Otto Porter at five. Like,
yeah, then that's not going to work for Simone Turner at all if they're playing out a Porter at the five.
I mean, yeah. I mean, in their instance, like, if they have Markieff Howard, then Markieff sort of becomes similar to what they did against Cleveland, because you can kind of do with Morris what they did with Jeff Green, or, like, earlier in the season, what they did with Jay Crowder and let Turner sag off. So, I mean, that one's sort of a maybe, but, I mean, I don't know. I just don't think that there's going to be this, like, influx of traditional front courts in the NBA. But
yeah, and they have to get over the hump, right? The hump is Boston and Toronto. Those are the teams they have to get over, and those teams are not going to do that.
Even Philly has options. I mean, like, Saric is going to be, I mean, one of the best things that he did for them last year was hit trailer threes, which means that one of your bigs is going to have to be lifted covering that. So
yeah, true. That's true. Saric, I mean, I guess with them, because they're playing Simmons at point guard, basically, they've got so many, like, tall guys, I guess it's hard to judge their lineup at times, I guess, because they've got so many of, like, kind of the center types out there.
Yeah, and it depends how they're, what exactly they're going to do with Fultz, and how they're going, because I mean, if they're going to run Simmons, Fultz, Covington, Saric, and Embiid, or if they'll pull Saric out of the starting lineup and go even smaller and leave Redick there, then that creates different lineup issues. But
yeah, a lot of that also depends on, can Simmons shoot? I mean, that's going to be a huge factor in whatever they do. Is Simmons, is he a jump shooter all of a sudden this year, or what kind of changes there?
Yeah.
All right, I should mention that was not my number one, so that was your number two. I'm curious if my number two is actually your number one then, all right?
Okay.
So my number two was, how do all the expiring contract space has affect their season?
No, I actually didn't have this. Actually didn't, because I had written about it before, and I thought, well, if this way we'll get a different voice from Adam, because I thought you might bring it up. So,
all right, because I know you wrote about it, because it kind of, when you wrote it, it made me start thinking about it, because you think about it. So I players on expiring deals. So let's see. Darren Collison has an expiring contract, 1 year left, $10 million. Bojan, same contract, 1 year, $10 million left. Tyreke Evans on a one-year deal. Corey Joseph's got 1 year left. Turner's playing for a contract, basically. Thad Young's got 1 year left. Who else am I? Is that it, right? Am I missing anybody else? Kyle Quinn's on a one-year contract.
Right, because I think I had at the time when I wrote that, you know, TJ Leaf was still technically a maybe. Like, we were pretty sure he was going to take his third-year option, but it wasn't guaranteed at the time.
So Sabonis and Leaf got their options picked up. So you basically have, I think, six guys who are on one-year deals and a seventh guy who's kind of playing it, because Turner, he's got 1 year left, so he's a restricted free agent, but he's basically playing for his next big contract. So you've got seven guys competing for big contracts. Pacers have a ton of cap space, but there's been kind of rumors they're going to use it on something else besides their current players. So is there a bench? You know, this team last year was so good, they didn't have a ton of egos, right? It was all team chemistry. We're all one. We're underdogs or not. But I wonder if some of that seeps in this year. You know, there were some contentious moments with the Thad contract, for sure. I don't know. You know, I know a couple years ago, Bojan thought he could get like a four-year, $50 million deal before he got the Pacers' two-year 20 offer. So I don't know if he has expectations again to make that kind of money. Collison's probably heading into his last contract of his career, maybe his last multi-year deal he could probably get. Obviously, like I said, Miles is going for like the five-year 150 to 190 max if he can make an All-NBA team, which is highly unlikely, but whatever it is. And then you got Tyreke, who's, again, also same kind of situation as Collison, kind of playing for his next, maybe last big contract. So I wonder if all that kind of starts to affect the team at some point, especially, you know, there are only so many shots to go around, and Oladipo might take 20 of them, so then there's even less shots to go around.
Right. I mean, I think they all handled that pretty well at media day with their answers. But what you say at the beginning of the season can, you know, get different, especially if you're hitting, you know, any rough patches. Like, I think that's where Victor Oladipo's leadership is going to come in even bigger, obviously, than what it was last year, to keep people on the same page. Because, you know, it's only going to take one person, you know, not being in on the team first concept that was last year, because I mean, a lot of those people that you mentioned are guards. So, I mean, they're the ones that are going to be starting these possessions and having the ball. And obviously Miles and Sabonis growth is pretty pivotal this year. So if they're not getting touches because of that, you know, that's definitely a potential thing to monitor.
Yeah. I guess the issue I see that is with Turner the most. I think Collison is too much of a professional now. He's kind of,
right.
You know, Thad, I worry a little bit, but also I think Thad's kind of the same thing as Collison. He's a professional. He'll worry about it kind of at the end of the year, because that's kind of what he did. He didn't let it affect him last year either. During the season, he knew he had 1 year left kind of last year with the option. I was worried with Turner, because Turner, you know, he's not going to get an extension probably, it seems like, at this point. I would doubt it, right? You don't think he's going to extension, do you?
No, I do not.
So he's probably going, looking at, you know, if he has a fantastic year where he can get 15 shots a game and put up an 18 and 12, I mean, this is like, maybe absurd to think he can do that. He could probably get like a ridiculous max. He probably looks at Clint Capella's 5 year 90 as his floor, and looks at Towns' 5 years 190 as his max. Or I don't know if he can qualify for that. Maybe he has to make it. It makes an All-NBA team, might be able to. But that's what he looks at. Like, he could be looking at like a 9-figure deal that could like life changing, alter his family for generations kind of money. And I don't know if that starts to affect him if he's not getting kind of the shots that he thinks he should get. You know, last year I think he got hurt and he kind of was okay kind of being in the back, but I wonder if that changes this year, as he has definitely gotten better in the offseason, or thinks he has. So I wonder if there's that comes some tension at some point,
right? Because I mean, definitely last year, I was looking at these numbers, because I was, some of the stuff you mentioned earlier about Corey Joseph playing in three guard lineups, this is how I came across it, because I was looking to see what Corey's minutes were like in the fourth quarter. I mean, and some of this is because they played the bench longer at the beginning of fourth quarters last year, but he actually led the team in fourth quarter minutes. So then that got me thinking, and I wanted to look at Miles versus Sabonis, and Sabonis averaged quite a few more minutes and in the fourth than Miles, which is what we would assume, because there were several games where he got, you know, DNPs, where Sabonis was in some of those games, especially where they were kind of clawing back and comebacks, they went with Sabonis. So you bring up a good point. Like, Miles was definitely like sort of the cheerleader in those situations from the bench. Like, he was very supportive. And, you know, there's these pictures this summer of them working out together in Dallas and, you know, trying to build that chemistry of if they're playing together. But, you know, it definitely, with him being in a contract year, it's something that you hope that continues to carry over.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I wasn't surprised by the Joseph stat, though, actually. Remember, Joseph closed a lot of games at point guard. Like, there was at least the first half of the year, and then Collison got hurt for a little bit. I mean, he closed a lot of games. I mean, he seemed like he was, like, the most almost reliable.
Oh, it's because he does so much on defense. Like, yeah. I think I tweeted that yesterday, because I was putting something on, something I did for the Phoenix blog, because they were wanting to know questions about some of their point guard targets they had. And Corey, if you look up at the numbers on like just his defensive average speed, was second in the NBA to Andre Roberson, which, I mean, granted, Roberson only played like 30 some games last year, but I mean, that just shows how active he is on the defensive end. Like, I mean, I'm a big proponent of Corey. Most people know that from some of the stuff that I wrote, but yeah.
He's another one of the guys too, also on an expiring deal, and he's looking probably for like maybe a starting point guard job, or or at least like, a four-year contract. I mean, he's only 27 years old. He's looking probably for a four-year contract this offseason if he can get it, especially all the cap space. So it's another, you know,
you would another thing to consider. You probably know a little bit. You seem to know stuff probably a little more than I do about the cap situation and contracts. But I mean, just like this year, so many players took one-year contracts to get back into the market next year because it's not as cash-strapped. But it's like you're also flooding the market with a lot more free agents because so many of them took one-year deals. Like,
oh yeah, that'll be an issue. I thought of that. Like, I mean, I haven't done the numbers but I wonder how much cap space there are to players who will be available and how that kind of plays out. That's gonna be an interesting dynamic, especially, you know, like the Butler one actually is kind of a good barometer, because like, is he gonna get a max deal next summer? Because people are now, there's been whispers or been talked about, like, well, do you really want to give him a 5-year, $190 million or whatever the max can be for him, you know, because he's,
because of the mileage he's had on him.
35. And so that's the question there. And then, you know, some of the things too is because in the NBA, right, you can kind of go over for your own free agents. So that will help a guy like Turner, for example. You know, Turner probably won't sign to like the second week of free agency or end of the first week, because the Pacers will say, especially if they're going to resign to a big deal, they'll say, we'll take care of you, but you got to wait because you're such a low cap hold. We're going to sign all these guys. Same with Porzingis, is kind of the same way next season with the Knicks. Like, there's more flexibility. Like with the NFL, you're just hard capped. You can't go over a number, but the NBA, you can go above this number to sign your own players. So you know, like a guys who have bird rights. So I think, right, so Thad Young will qualify for bird rights because this is his third year with the Pacers. So he'll be one of the few players that can go over the cap to bring back. I think they still get Joseph Burris because they traded for him. But guys like Collison and Bogdan and Tyreek, they don't have bird rights. So they don't offer them so much money. So it'll be interesting to see kind of what happens, I guess, with that whole thing.
Right. Those are all good points.
Yeah, there's a – that the cap thing is probably not to worry about until they hit, like you said, hit a little rough patch, because that will be when you might see some tensions flare. But let's go to your number one. What was your number one thing? I'm interested now.
My number one is just is Miles Turner. How does his workouts translate to the regular season? I mean, I think he's got to be the story this year. He was a little bit put on the back burner because Victor's, you know, usage really ballooned when he came here because it was about establishing him for the most part last year. But I mean, just for a lot of the things we mentioned, just, you know, his touches, how does that impact his field goal attempts? But I mean, more than anything, he's talked a lot at Media Day about how he's moving better. He's more fluid. And, you know, that's easy to daydream about, you know, him anchoring the pick and roll and being more fluid defending in space. But, I mean, that's getting in better shape and better condition and being more agile is one thing. But he's also got to be able to show growth in terms of how he reads and reacts to plays, whether it's making reads out of the short roll or just – you know, defensively, I brought this up a lot, but sometimes you could see a lot of times last year, like his synergy numbers defending rollers were not good last year because, you know, if it's two-man game and there's three shooters dotting the strong side of the floor, you could tell sometimes that he would stay too, like a beat too long with the ball handler and the roller's getting free because there's not going to be any weak side tag coming. And that's something that's not just about him moving better. That's something that's him making a recognition that, hey, this is what the opposing team's running and there's not a tag coming. I have to stay attached to, you know, Bam Adebayo or whoever it is that's rolling to the basket. So, I mean, I want to find a happy middle between, like, I know a lot of people are like already assuming that this is going to be like Victor summer for Miles. And I don't want to automatically assume that. And I also don't want to automatically assume, you know, it's Roy Hibbert watching Kung Fu videos with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar one day. Like, I'm not saying it's going to be that, but I also don't want people to go in with the expectation that it's going to be, you know, day and night what Victor was on day one of the preseason last year.
So the recognizing defenders thing is sort of similar to his offense we talked about, kind of where he just doesn't quite process the game fast enough at times. So I wonder, and I don't know how you, I don't know if you can really improve that without, you know, it's just by playing, right? So you get better at recognizing certain defensive sets or whatever it is, kind of figuring out where guys are going to go, how they cut by watching a lot, right? That's how you get better at that per se. It's not right. A natural thing. It's not like, and I wonder with Turner because, you know, he has some of these awesome physical gifts. He's 7 feet tall. He's got a good jump shot. I mean, that's probably somewhat developed, but and he can protect the rim. And I guess I wonder if his improvement is not improving the other things, but just improving the things he's already good at too at times.
Exactly. Like,
is that how he becomes better? Is he going to be a 40% 3-point shooter? Because they're going to give him to him 5 times a game, let's say. I mean, that's a huge thing. If he can shoot, let's say 40% on 5% a game, that's 6 points a game right there. That's easy for him. And are they going to, you know, he has always talked about he wants to post guys up. And I know he doesn't do that a ton, but will they maybe give him more of those opportunities, the right switches, or will they let him put the ball on the ground and go to the rim and do things like that? You know, it just depends. And will they design the defense more around running guys into him on the at the rim like they did with Hibbert back in the day, where basically you all their defenders kind of played up and they were okay with being beat because they had Roy Hibbert back there to block the rim. Will they do that? Like, there's things that they could do to kind of accent Turner's strengths. So I don't know if that's what they'll do or what will happen. I think last year too, a huge thing you got is his injuries. His injuries kind of kept throwing off his momentum, you know.
Right.
First game got hurt, concussion, missed I think 7 or 8 games. Then he kind of got kind of back in the flow of it, and then he got the elbow injury, missed another 10 or 11 games. I mean, he never really got into a flow, and so.
And those things definitely have lingering effects because, I mean, with the concussion, I mean, he's literally, you know, laying in a dark room. Like, he's not only is he not playing, but his conditioning, he has to build all the way back up. So there's definitely lingering aspects of that. And I know that people really like to harp on, like, the overall aggressiveness, the rebounding. And, I mean, I definitely think that's a thing. I mean, I'm a little shocked by Nate saying that their goal is to be a top 10 rebounding team again because – that would put them back in the space of what those smash mouth teams were. And at the same time, there's a few things at Media Day where he also said that they still want to play faster, you know, as they should, because they were really good in the open floor when you know, they actually pressed off of whether it's fast breaks or transition opportunities. But I'm not sure how you do both of those things well. I don't, because if you're going to have to send guards down to smash, you know, elite rebounders, then they're not going to be leaking out in transition to be getting some of those fast break opportunities. So you're therefore not going to be playing as fast. You're not going to be generating as many possessions unless they continue to force like a ton of turnovers. So, I mean, I think that's really going to be a delicate balance between the rebounding, because I mean, then are they playing Kyle O'Quinn to try to boost that? Like, does he make it into the bench rotation? Which that could have been one of these storylines to watch, because I'm kind of expecting that eventually. Are you expecting they're eventually going to play Kyle O'Quinn at four?
Didn't he say they want to run a 9-man rotation? I'm not sure.
They did. They did. So that would mean that they don't have a plan for backup four right now. But I know that Nate did say he was really impressed with Kyle O'Quinn at training camp this week.
But O'Quinn, the ninth guy, right? McDermott's eight and O'Quinn's nine? Or no? No, right? Wouldn't it be?
No, because backups would be Corey, Tyreek, McDermott, Sabonis. And
that's nine. So, yeah. So I thought that O'Quinn was out when I did that.
Right. Right. I think he will start. I don't think that they'll play somebody in that spot to begin with, but I won't be surprised if sort of like what happened with Booker after February, if, you know, O'Quinn's in the rotation to boost the rebounding. And
yeah.
Which, granted, you know, that I shouldn't even necessarily compare directly to Booker, because O'Quinn has more, you know, offensively, he's going to be able to do more passing and stuff with Sabonis than what they got out of Trevor Booker. So I don't want people to think that I'm equating them to being the exact same player, because they're not.
No, and Booker's like, what, 2 or 3 inches smaller, too. That's a huge thing. I mean, he's not the same size as O'Quinn.
Right.
He's a huge dude. But I want to hit back on your point about the pace, because, you know, last year they – before the season, it was like, we're going to run ridiculous pace, scored 140 points that first game. And then basically they settled in kind of the way they did really the year before with McMillan too, is they found the right balance of how to be good on defense and still at times be fast. But I wonder, because watching Turner's offseason workouts, he seemed like he's trying to become a center who can push the ball, right? Kind of like Draymond right. does with the Warriors. And I wonder if, you know, you sacrifice rebounding by doing that, right? By just pushing the, but I wonder if there's something there where like you can, they can have Turner rebound the ball and he just pushes it up, because that would be huge, because that could allow, you know, Oladipo to get a step ahead on everybody else already instead of having to wait to get the ball. And I don't know if they'll do that or if they have plans to do that, but it seems like that would be kind of the most kind of new thing that could take them another level, at least kind of the most kind of a new wrinkle to the game for them. Because if Turner can push the ball, I mean, that's just going to make their offensive basically fast breaks even like, even better. And if he can make it a long pass too, I mean, that's
I would see it more along that lines. I don't think I'll expect to see him pushing it much in transition unless he's gotten a lot more comfortable off the dribble. But I mean, some of those videos with him hitting pull up threes, I could definitely see if they're pushing it in transition and Victor's, you know, busting it to the rim, that having Miles as a trailer three would be, you know, a boon over what they had last year, because you weren't really seeing Miles hit that type of a three-point shot where he's stepping into it or he's grabbing it in transition and pulling up, you know, from a, you know, a couple feet, taking a dribble and hitting a three. But I mean, Thad can definitely do that. Thad can push the ball in transition. I mean, he doesn't get much opportunity to do it, but he can.
Yeah. I just think, I mean, I'm looking at some of the videos of Turner in my head. It's just, it was him getting, pushing up and pulling up on threes. And I don't know if it's because he was playing against really kind of scrubs basically. Yeah. And that's why he was able to do it. But I mean, I guess in my head, I'm envisioning like a way where if Turner could push the ball and make like kind of like the long pass, almost like, you know how the D-Wade LeBron passes used to be, where they were like, with D-Wade chuck it like half court basically and LeBron get the brim and just dunk it in. Like, that's what I'm sort of imagining, but I feel like that's probably too.
Yeah, like a long outlet pass.
That's probably too optimistic, right? Those are like over two right. of the best, like three players when they're playing together.
Yeah.
I guess with Turner, I guess my hope is just that he can, like you said, hit some of the more, like the trailing threes, just be more involved in the offense, right? I mean, that was the issue. I felt like he was sometimes just like, they gave him the first couple of shots and they stopped using him at all. And I don't know whether that's because he said trying to establish Vic, what it was. I would hope he could be more involved this year. That's all
I think. Yeah, I think it was like a threefold thing, because you're establishing Victor, you're letting him play through mistakes and grow. And they also pigeonholed Miles a little bit, because that's getting him shots. Or getting him the ball out of the spread pick and roll was also a way that they opened up threes. Because, you know, if people collapse to him there at the free throw line, then you're opening up shooters. So he got pigeonholed a little bit that way. And then clear back what I started at the beginning with the switches, it goes back to, it's a mixture of him needing to be more aggressive against it and them also coming equipped with built-in actions to ensure that if they do switch, he can still get the ball like there's responsibility on both sides, but I hope that both sides worked on getting to the point where his touches aren't stagnant for a third consecutive season.
Yeah, like, I also think part of it too was they played a lot of close games. And so like if they were blowing teams out, Turner might have got more opportunities to just like take shots, just because I mean like there are games that are blowing teams opponents taking threes. I remember that's when, you know, they were up by 20 points. Nobody cared to take three, but they were playing so many close games and Vic was the best player to have the ball in his hands in a close game. So it just it again kind of pushed Turner even further down. It was like, you know what, we want to win. That's what we're worried about right now. We're not worried about developing you. We're really worried about winning tonight's game to win, you know, to get to the 4 or 5 seed in the East kind of stuff.
Right. And in some of those situations, I mean, Sabonis was on the floor, quite frankly, like where Nate just decided that in those situations, he felt more confident in playing Sabonis than he did Miles. So,
yeah, well, especially because Sabonis, I think Sabonis just plays so much better off Oladipo in it. And I don't, maybe Turner can get there because they seem like Turner and Oladipo do have kind of a chemistry, at least off the court. It seemed like they're at least a building one. It seemed like I watched some of their uninterrupted videos from last year too. They seem they have something going. So maybe that will help that too.
Right. And some of it with Sabonis goes back to just how fluid he is when he's running dribble handoffs, which is where Victor can really be pretty lethal, going from a relaxed stance in the corner to exploding off those, you know, left side dribble handoffs with Sabonis. So,
yeah. And they got a year together in Oklahoma City. I mean, that's a huge thing when you get to play a year. I mean, he may not play all the time with Sabonis, but he got a year of seeing Sabonis play and understood his game a little better, where he had never played with Turner. So that was sort of like, it's going to be growing pains no matter what.
And Miles is a little bit behind too, because I mean, sometimes it's easy for me to forget, at least, that he only played 1 year of college basketball, and Sabonis, you know, had multiple seasons at Gonzaga, whereas Miles had 1 year at Texas before he went into the NBA. So I think Sabonis has a little bit more polish in that respect too.
And Sabonis' dad helps. I mean,
right.
Having an NBA parent is huge. I think for most, I mean, most of the guys in this league who've had NBA parents seem to have a step up in everybody else. Curry, Klay Thompson, name it. All those guys do.
So what was that your number one, too, or what was your number one?
So mine was the Turner and Sabonis playing together.
Oh, that's right.
I incorporated the Turner's improvement into that one, sort of my mind.
Right. I hesitated. I couldn't decide if I thought that was one topic or not. So.
Yeah, but so – you want to let's do our top five list real quick, just so people can know, and then we can finish up. So you want to give me your top five real quick?
All right. So number one was Miles. Number two was, can Miles and Sabonis play together? Number three was the backcourt rotation, and then will they eventually get to a Houston style guard tandem rotation with Tyreek and Oladipo? Number four was whether Victor takes another leap this year. And number five was the long-term solution and the overall just wing small forward rotation situation.
Okay, so I think we only had like three overlapping. So I had Sabonis Turner one, which you had. I had the trade one. Did the Pacers make a trade this season? And how does that affect the team as two on my list? I had three was the forward one, which you had. Four was expiring contracts, which you said you've written about, so I guess you didn't keep it on your top five, but I know you've written about, like I read your article
right
earlier this summer. And then the fifth one I had was the Oladipo jump. So I think we only had three overlapping, which is kind of, I guess that's not too bad. I thought we'd have more than that, to be honest.
No, I'm glad that we didn't though, because I was glad that you brought up the extra things that I didn't include.
Yeah,
so
no, it was perfect. All right. Is there any, so I know I previewed it before the show that your season preview is coming out October 4th, which is going to be Monday, right?
Right. So just a little bit of a teaser, like SB Nation's main page is like overall preview, which I know I can't give anything away of it, but I know that it's going to be pretty cool what they have planned. That's on the 9th. And then the individual team size, which will be one of mine, it's more in the vein of what I think people will expect. I will tease one thing. I compared something to a childhood toy. Ooh. that I'm hoping that other people actually know what the toy is. Like after I've written this whole thing, like this is something that I played with, but I hope other people did, because if not, then people are gonna be like, what is this crazy person talking about? But the other one that I have coming on Monday is totally not anything that I normally do. It's something different that one of my favorite people on the internet helped me out with. So
all right, well,
I think it's going to be a fun one. And then you have your Victor piece coming out that I think you said.
Yeah, I'm going to have that come out, I think, Monday or Tuesday. I'll see when you have stuff posted. I try to not post this around. Try to time or post that a little better is what I'm trying to do. But that's going to come out on Monday or Tuesday.
Yeah, we're going to have a busy week. People need to head over.
Yeah, so. Head over to IndieCornrows.com, and we'll have all your page coverage because the season's what now? So this podcast is going to say goes on Monday the 1st. That means 16 days of the season, right? 17th?
Right, yeah.
So 16 days of the season, and then we'll be in full swing, and there'll be all kinds of stuff on IndieCornrows.com to read. I mean, there'll be probably breakdowns of every game. It'll be stuff to read every single day almost. So people should check that out.
Yep.
All right, Kaylin, thanks for joining me. That's all we got for this Locked On Pacers podcast. As always, you can follow me at FreedomAdam5. You can follow Kaylin. What's your Twitter handle?
At C2 underscore Cooper.
Yeah, it's good. It's a really good follow, particularly during games sometimes. She always has some good insights or something she saw or whatever. She does a really good job of that. I don't do a great job of tweeting during games sometimes, but Kaylin does, because that's how if I miss a quarter like that, I'm like, oh, I'll just go read Kaylin's Twitter feed and I'll see what's going on. Or I'll like kind of pull up a few feeds and like that's one of them I definitely see, because she'll have some good insights on games that are going on. You can follow my other co-host Tony East at TSNBA. You can follow this podcast at Locked On Pacers. As always, leave us reviews on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or tweet at us, you know, what you thought of this podcast. And as always, you can listen to us every Monday. Me and Tony will be back, I think, sometime midweek. And we're probably doing 5 days a week starting in October. That's all for this Locked On Pacers podcast. As always, have a great rest of your day.